You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Disease du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke with Dr. Amy Johnson about non-infectious neurologic diseases in horses, specifically CVSM and ENaD-EDM. This episode of Disease du Jour is brought to you by Equithrive. Dr. Amy Johnson is board certified in large animal internal medicine and neurology, and was the first American veterinarian to obtain these credentials. Her clinical caseload consists predominantly of horses with neurologic problems, including spinal cord compression, neurodegenerative disease, and infectious diseases. She also provides consultations for farm animals with neurologic disease. Her research efforts focus on improving our ability to diagnose the cause of neurologic disease in horses. Dr. Johnson has worked at Penn Vet's New Bolton Center since 2007 and is the current section chief of internal medicine and ophthalmology. Thank you, Dr. Johnson, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So to get us started, what are some of the most common non-infectious neurologic diseases you encounter in horses?
So in my caseload, and I presume in most other people's as well, the two most common probably are those that cause spinal or proprioceptive ataxia, which would include cervical vertebral stenotic myelopathy, or people might just say neck problems in general, and then the neurodegenerative conditions, equine neuroaxonal dystrophy, or equine degenerative myeloencephalopathy, which may very well be a spectrum of the same neurodegenerative disorder.
And do you find that certain types of horses or, you know, certain disciplines of horses are more predisposed to some of these conditions, or is it fairly random?
Yeah, absolutely. Any horse could be affected with either of those conditions, but I think there are certainly groups that are predisposed. So for CVSM, or the horses that have spinal cord compression due to malformation or abnormal development of the vertebral column, a lot of those cases are younger, rapidly growing male horses, particularly thoroughbreds, although we see it in warmbloods and we see it in older horses as well. And we know that that spinal cord compression can happen because of malformation of the bones of the neck itself, or sometimes because of the onset of degenerative joint disease or arthritis in the neck that over time leads to kind of a slower spinal cord compression. And that's why we can see it in old horses as well as young horses. Regarding the neurodegenerative diseases, which we'll just call ENaD and EDM for the purpose of this conversation, I think that they've been described in many different breeds, and historically those conditions were best recognized in younger horses, maybe 6 months to a year of age, in actually quite a number of different breeds, so quarter horses and Morgans and Arabians and other breeds as well. Now we see a lot more in young to middle-aged horses, but we're talking in the 5 to 15-year-old range. In my patient population, we see a lot of sport horses, and a lot of them seem to be warmbloods, with a tendency for having been imported from Europe. But of course, a lot of people in the United States these days own warmbloods that have been imported from Europe. We certainly also see it in horses that were born and raised in the United States, and we see it in other breeds as well, besides warmbloods. We see it in thoroughbreds, standardbreds, quarter horses, even some ponies. But in my case population, it's a lot of young to middle-aged warmbloods.
Right. So when you mention male horses being more predisposed to CVSM, is that uncut horses or are geldings and stallions equally sort of at risk?
Well, when you think about the thoroughbreds, a lot of the youngsters are intact. So a lot of them are stallions or colts, I should say. But I do think that it is more to do, as far as I can tell, from the size of the horse and the rate of growth. So there's a certain phenotype we see with the young version of the wobblers or the horses with CVSM, where they tend to be very tall and lanky. And of course, you can see fillies or mares that have the same basic body shape, but it's just a little bit less common than they grow as rapidly as do the colts.
Right. Okay, great. Well, we're going to talk about all of those conditions in a little bit more detail later on. But before we do that, can you just explain some of the early signs that might make you suspicious that a horse has a neurodisease? And how do you start to differentiate between infectious and non-infectious causes?
So for the early signs, I think that it often starts with just a performance decline if the horse is in work. For some of these youngsters, of course, they haven't even entered training yet. And for those horses, unless they are intensively worked in hand, I think that sometimes the earlier signs are actually missed when they're out in a field running with their friends. And so they have to show more severe ataxia or loss of coordination before anybody picks up on the fact that they are showing signs of neurologic disease. If the horse is in work already, if it's reached that stage of its career, then I think the signs tend to be a little bit more subtle when they're noticed. So it may be a decline in performance. The horse starts knocking down rails or having refusals at fences or tripping a little bit under saddle, maybe failing to learn more complicated maneuvers in dressage, just can't quite move up to the next level. Maybe a toe drag or just a change in the way, the quality of the horse's gait compared to what the owner is used to. And sometimes it is recognized as neurologic disease from the start, but sometimes it's not. And many other disease conditions can even be blamed, things like the horse isn't moving well because it has gastric ulcers, or the saddle doesn't fit, or even, you know, lameness is very common because the rider can feel that the horse isn't moving as it used to, but maybe not recognize exactly why at that point.
Right. So it's probably a little bit of a slower progression than like an infectious disease, which I would imagine have a more sudden onset.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And some of the infectious diseases always have a rapid onset and progression until either recovery or, in bad cases, death occurs. And especially the viral diseases, they tend to progress over days and then similarly recover or, you know, require euthanasia within a similar time frame. These non-infectious diseases are more likely to cause the slowly progressive problem over time that may be months or even years before they're recognized as neurologic disease. There are exceptions to that, of course. Horses that have CVSM and have very mild spinal cord compression, or potentially even don't have any spinal cord compression in a very neutral head and neck position, may get themselves into a situation where their neck is abruptly flexed or extended in a way that the spinal cord is damaged by the narrow vertebral canal and show an acute onset of signs for what was probably a more chronic condition. But I think you're absolutely right that the slower, more insidious diseases are often the non-infectious types. Although I teach my veterinary students that EPM can do whatever it wants, and yeah. EPM is the one infectious disease that can kind of linger and be insidious some of the time.
Right. This episode of Disease du Jour is sponsored by Equithrive. Brought to you by Equithrive, the leaders in resveratrol science, Medicare is a new pelleted daily supplement offering metabolic support for easy keepers. Medicare was formulated by Pat Lawless, PhD, to support optimum carbohydrate and fat metabolism, healthy body weight, and appropriate insulin levels in horses, thanks to a proprietary combination of resveratrol, flavonoids, and amino acids. Learn more at www.equithrive.com. Can you walk us through your initial examination when you have a horse that has a suspected neurodisease? You can walk us through your neurologic exam, but I also imagine there are probably some other steps to your exam to rule out some other causes of lameness in some of these less specific horses.
Yeah, absolutely. So we always start with a basic physical examination, to be honest with you, just to make sure that the horse doesn't have any signs of systemic disease, because obviously if a horse is ill or feels badly, they don't perform as well on a neurologic exam. For the neurologic exam itself, we usually have a fairly consistent routine where we evaluate the horse's attitude and behavior, looking for any changes in behavior, although to be honest with you, the owner or the trainer, the barn manager, is often a better judge of whether the horse has demonstrated a behavior change because they know the horses so much better than I do. We evaluate all of the nerves that innervate the structures of their face, the cranial nerve examination. We look at spinal segmental reflexes. All of this is done kind of with the horse in a stall, standing still. And then we take the horse out for a gait evaluation. The way that I like to perform my gait evaluations is I start with the more simple procedures and maneuvers. So just walking in a straight line, trotting in a straight line. And then I increase the level of complexity of what we're asking the horse to do so that if they do have kind of subtle neurologic deficits, it becomes more apparent. So that's things like walking in a serpentine, walking with the head elevated in the air to remove the horse's horizon and decrease their ability to compensate visually, pulling on the tail to assess their strength, both walking and standing, walking in really tight circles, which is a pretty sensitive test for awareness of where their limbs are, their proprioception. And then we might do an incline, walking up and down hills with and without their head elevated, or cavalletti poles, having them back up. And by doing that, we hope to be able to basically induce any subtle neurologic deficits to become apparent to us. We also, as part of our routine exam, if they know how to lunge, we'll put them on a lunge line and look for any lameness, not because I am necessarily a lameness expert, but because I want to know if there is any potential orthopedic disease that's severe enough that it will impact my assessment of the neurologic exam, because horses that have a lameness often don't perform well during the neurologic examination. And some horses are tricky and they have multiple problems at the same time. And then it's important to figure out which is more limiting in terms of that horse's overall performance and which really is the one that probably prompted the owner to seek veterinary care.
Now, are there specific findings during this initial neuro exam that might make you more suspicious of CVSM or ENaD or EDM, or is it still pretty vague at this point and would require further diagnostic procedures to narrow it down?
Yeah, it can be really hard to tell. Going back to the whole infectious versus non-infectious, that both of the non-infectious diseases that we see commonly, CVSM and ENaD-EDM, they tend to have fairly symmetric clinical signs, meaning that all four limbs are affected and there's not a severe left or right-sided, you know, difference in severity. Diseases like EPM or some of the other infectious diseases, they can be symmetric, but oftentimes there's some more profound asymmetry where the limbs on one side will clearly be worse than the other, or they'll have muscle atrophy that is not symmetric, that is worse on one side than the other. So symmetry pushes me a bit more towards non-infectious, and asymmetry definitely pushes me more towards infectious. But again, that's a rule of thumb and not an absolute. And obviously, we didn't talk about this earlier, but if the horse has a fever documented before they come into the hospital or while they're in the hospital, that certainly makes us more concerned about infectious disease. Although the most common infectious disease, EPM, does not cause a fever. So again, the water can be a little bit murky sometimes. From the actual ataxia standpoint or the neurologic exam, I think that in terms of guessing whether or not the horse is going to have a final diagnosis of CVSM or ENaD-EDM, and maybe I shouldn't say guessing, maybe I should say predicting, because I like to think that I'm using the scientific method here. It has to do a lot of the times, honestly, with the signalment of the horse and the history that the owner gives me, as well as what the horse looks like. Again, if it is a young, very large thoroughbred colt in training, I'm going to be more suspicious of CVSM than I am of EDM with the exact same clinical signs. And if it's the same sort of ataxia, but now the horse is a bit older and it has a short little neck and is not very tall, and especially if it has some of the other, what I kind of consider soft features of neurodegenerative disease, which seems more likely to cause a change in behavior and sometimes some very unusual behaviors, I would be more concerned about neurodegenerative disease than CVSM.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I would love to go a little bit more into detail now on some of these specific conditions, starting with CVSM. What does the actual diagnostic process look like for this disease? And do you find you can usually narrow it down to a pretty definitive diagnosis, or are you still, is there still sort of some ambiguity with these cases?
I think in neurology, there's always a little bit of ambiguity, but we're pretty good at CVSM. So here we typically start with just survey cervical radiographs, and you can't diagnose the presence of spinal cord compression on survey radiographs, of course, because you can't visualize the spinal cord. But there are certain morphologic features in the bones that might make CVSM become more or less likely if you see them. So some evidence of narrowing of the vertebral canal or clear osteochondral fragments or degenerative joint disease of the articular process joints or malalignment of the vertebra, all of those things might make you suspicious that the horse does have CVSM off the survey radiographs. We usually recommend, whenever feasible, at doing advanced imaging, which currently the best imaging that's available for horses is usually CT myelography. So the myelogram invariably lets you get views that we consider dynamic. So with the head and neck in different positions, now with the spinal cord outlined by a contrast material so that we can see if it is being compressed at any specific site in any head or neck position. CT is great because it provides cross-sectional imaging. And so unlike the standard survey myelogram that gives us a lot of information about dorsoventral compression, basically coming from the top down, the CT allows us to see lateral and dorsolateral compression that previously we probably missed looking at standard myelograms, and it kind of gives you a whole view of what's happening to the spinal cord. Now, that being said, I always tell my clients that it's possible that your myelogram is clearly negative, where there's no spinal cord compression, and we clear them of having CVSM, or it can be clearly positive, where anybody looks at the study and says, yes, there's compression at this site. I'm very confident that the spinal cord is being affected. But then there's this gray period, or I guess gray set of images in the middle, where there is certainly reduction of the size of the vertebral canal, and there's not enough room, or not as much room, I guess I should say, for the spinal cord at a particular site. But at the same time, we're not confident that it's really being compressed. So it's hard to say whether there's barely enough room or barely not enough room, given the constraints of the imaging. And so people have looked over the years for more functional tests to try to use electrodiagnostics or something like that to sort out those cases and figure out if there really is spinal cord compression. But it is hard sometimes. And you basically, there's no standard series of measurements that gives you perfect precision or diagnostic accuracy. Your best bet is to get somebody who looks at a lot of studies and potentially also has a lot of kind of post-mortem follow-up over the years to interpret the study and say whether or not they think the horse is being compressed in conjunction with all your other clinical information. You know, you want to make sure that you test for EPM and for other possibilities that could be causing similar clinical signs.
Yeah, is there a pretty clear association between clinical signs and severity of the CT scan, or are some of those gray horses sometimes some of the more severe presenters?
Yeah, I wish there were, and that has not been my clinical experience, that the imaging does not match the clinical signs perfectly. And that's true in all of neurology. Even when I was doing my training and doing a little bit more with cats and dogs, the severity of the lesion on the imaging was not necessarily correlated to the severity of the signs of the animal in front of you, which is really, really frustrating. And to be honest with you, it's the same even from pathology, when we get those results, and that the lesions that the pathologists are able to detect, sometimes they're very minimal despite a horse that couldn't even stand. And sometimes they say, my gosh, this horse, how is this horse even standing? We see such severe lesions in the brain and the spinal cord. And you're like, I thought that was going to be my normal control for a research study. So that is another really frustrating aspect of this, is that things don't match perfectly. So just because you have a gray zone study and a more severely affected horse, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have the wrong diagnosis.
Yeah, that definitely complicates things. So what is your typical approach to treatment for this condition, especially with some of these gray area horses, and what does the prognosis look like?
So treatment can be divided into more of a conservative management approach versus surgery as being maybe a more aggressive but definitive treatment approach. And for the gray zone horses, sometimes what we do is we start with a conservative approach, which often involves a decreased level of exercise, less stress on the neck, as well as anti-inflammatory treatment, sometimes given systemically, and sometimes if the joints are involved, injected intraarticularly to try to decrease inflammation surrounding the spinal cord and kind of shrink back any soft tissue swelling that might be near the spinal cord. And if the horse responds really well to that, that can be a strong indicator that the horse actually has a compressive lesion. And then you can decide, if the response is fairly short-lived, whether you want to consider a more definitive treatment approach like surgery, should the signs return. In some cases, say in the horse that has a stenotic canal, but not spinal cord compression all the time, that sustained some kind of trauma that led to the onset of clinical signs, the conservative management might be enough, assuming that horse is smart enough not to get itself into the same situation again and sustain that kind of trauma. So just the conservative management with rest and anti-inflammatories may lead to sustained improvement. If the compression is consistently present, or if it is recurring every time the horse lowers its head to graze or picks its head up to look at something, probably conservative management will eventually fail, even if it transiently improves the horse's clinical signs. And in that case, the most common surgical procedure performed is a cervical fusion surgery, whereby two adjacent vertebrae are fused either with the traditional basket implant or with some of the newer implants that involve spacers and little plates. There's also additional newer surgical procedures, most notably the foraminotomy, which have been applied to horse necks. Those generally relieve compression on nerve roots and spinal nerves rather than the spinal cord itself. So they're usually not suitable if the horse truly has spinal cord compression. But those are the treatment options. And as far as prognosis, I think there are very few studies right now that look at hard numbers in terms of prognosis. I think that the people who do surgery frequently will say that maybe as many as 80% of horses that receive surgery will improve, and maybe 50 to 60% will go back to their intended purpose or go back to a ridden career. In one study that looked at young thoroughbreds that were being managed conservatively rather than surgically, I think the number was about half that. So maybe about 30% went back, you know, had a start, went back into racing. So the prognosis is dependent on whether you choose conservative management or surgical management. But it is, you know, it's quite variable. And the prognosis I'll tell owners is based on the horse, the intended purpose of the horse, the severity of signs, the severity of the imaging findings. It's not something that can be applied with a blanket statement to all horses.
Right. Okay, well, moving on to ENAD and EDM, what does the diagnostic process look like for this condition? And how do you sort of reach a definitive diagnosis, or is it even possible to reach a definitive diagnosis?
Yeah. For the neurodegenerative diseases, they're really tricky. And in the living horse, they are a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that we don't have any test that will tell you definitively that the horse has the disease. So that's really, really frustrating. We base our diagnosis on the presence of compatible clinical signs, especially things in the history in terms of the onset of disease, you know, again, slowly progressive over time, the signalment of the horse, whether or not there are any behavior changes present in the horse, as well as ruling out conditions that can look similar. So it often involves ruling out the presence of spinal cord compression by doing the imaging to show that they are not a horse with CVSM, and doing spinal fluid analyses to rule out infectious disease conditions like EPM that could potentially also mimic the clinical signs. Some supportive things could include a horse that has a low vitamin E blood concentration, because we know that low levels of vitamin E can predispose to this disease, or they're a documented risk factor. Sometimes we'll also do muscle biopsies specifically of the tail head muscle. We know that prolonged severe vitamin E deficiency can cause changes in the tail head muscle, and we don't think that those changes go away even when the vitamin E deficiency has been corrected. So in some horses, they may have had a vitamin E deficiency early in life that kind of set them up for the possibility of neurodegenerative disease, but in their current management, they have adequate vitamin E ingestion or supplementation, so their blood level is okay. But if we look at the tailhead biopsy, we still see evidence that at one point in their life, they didn't have enough. So that's, again, it's not confirmatory for the disease. It just helps to provide some additional evidence. The only definitive means is postmortem evaluation of the brain and the spinal cord. And there are certain sites where we tend to see degeneration in these horses, and those are fairly well known. But it's frustrating for owners that right now those are not lesions that we can detect with CT. And as far as I know, no one has even used MRI to detect them. So to have some kind of functional imaging technique that would help us would be wonderful. We're just not quite there yet.
Yeah, it seems like it would be pretty time consuming and also costly to the owner to sort of rule out all of these other conditions before you can give, you know, your best assessment that the horse probably has this condition. So does this affect your approach to treatment at all? Well, first of all, what is your approach to treatment for this disease? But do you ever recommend, you know, starting some sort of treatment without really having a fully clear picture of what's going on with the horse?
Yeah, for the neurodegenerative diseases, the other tricky part about them is they don't have a consistent progression. And I think the same is true in people with neurodegenerative disease, where there can be long periods of stability or plateau, and then there can be rapid periods of deterioration, and there can even be improvement if a person undergoes, say, physical therapy or exercises more, you know, improves sleep and diet and all of these other factors. And so if the horse is safe for exercise, be that ridden exercise or ground exercise, with neurodegenerative disease, the more the horse exercises, often the better they do, because it maintains their muscle strength, it maintains coordination, it allows them to develop compensatory pathways for neurons that have been lost. The other thing that's helpful is supplementing vitamin E and kind of maintaining target blood levels of that to reduce any ongoing deficiency and make sure that they have adequate kind of antioxidant power in their body. And then treating anything else that's bothering the horse. So again, horses are not limited to one disease problem at a time. They often have neurodegenerative disease and some lameness. And what I've found is that sometimes horses can compensate really well for one problem, but if you start stacking additional problems on top of it, they just lose that compensatory ability. So if we have a horse that also has lameness and we address the lameness, they may be able to cope with their mild loss of coordination and strength and actually do quite well. So kind of holistically managing the rest of the horse and optimizing their health and comfort will help to slow down or reduce any signs of neurodegenerative disease.
And what does the prognosis typically look like? I imagine it's probably, again, very dependent on the individual case, but...
Yeah, it is very dependent on the individual case. And you know, I've seen horses that deteriorate fairly rapidly over half a year and necessitate euthanasia based on the severity of either their ataxia or their behavior changes. And I've seen other horses that have stayed in work and won major competitions years after I have diagnosed them with this problem, and everything in between, horses that are happily retired and horses that have had really erratic behavior and run through a fence and injured themselves requiring euthanasia. So it's very case dependent. And sometimes the way that we manage these horses depends predominantly on the horse's clinical signs, but also the owner's commitment to the horse, as well as their willingness to accept risk, does play into it a little bit, quite frankly. And so it's quite a variable prognosis that's based on the individual. In general, horses that develop kind of mild ataxia early in life that then stabilizes often do better long term than the horses that develop it later in life along with substantial behavior changes, especially horses that become aggressive or really erratic, because for obvious safety reasons, people are less tolerant of that and less willing to accept the risk of moving forward with a horse that might hurt them or somebody in the barn.
Yeah, that makes sense. For these more mild horses, do you find that eventually they decline, or can some of them sort of carry out a normal lifespan?
I think that some of them probably do carry out a normal lifespan. I have, you know, probably been diagnosing this condition most commonly in the last 10 years or so. So I don't have generations of horses that I can, you know, point to as follow-up and know this. But the tricky part too about neurodegenerative disease is that to a certain extent, neurodegeneration happens with aging. So as people and as horses get older, you lose some neurons. They eventually wear out and they die. And that's why, you know, you don't see a lot of 80-year-old people in the Olympics winning events, because at some point your coordination and your muscle strength just deteriorates as you get older. And the same is probably true in horses. So sorting out what is disease and what is aging, and do some horses just age at a more accelerated rate than others and they fall into a neurodegenerative category, it's something that hasn't been very well categorized yet. So we're trying very hard to get a better sense of what is normal for different aged horses, but it is still a work in progress.
Right. Awesome. Well, beyond CVSM and ENaD-EDM, are there any other non-infectious neuro diseases that practitioners should be aware of?
So yes is the short answer to that question. In terms of the, you know, ones that cause ataxia, they're definitely the most common. Then you get into certain diseases that could maybe cause cranial nerve deficits or signs. One of the best known is probably temporohyoid osteoarthropathy, or THO, which can cause a very acute onset of facial nerve paralysis or vestibular signs in a horse. And of course, that is basically an arthritic or a degenerative condition involving the temporohyoid joint of the skull. And then there's a disease called polyneuritis equi, which used to be probably called cauda equina syndrome, and that seems to be an immune-mediated inflammatory disease, and that can cause cranial nerve signs as well as cauda equina type signs, where the horse loses the ability to move its tail, urinate, defecate, loses sensation, things like that involving the back end. You could have nutritional deficiencies. So a vitamin E deficiency, in addition to being linked to ENaD-EDM, it can also cause equine motor neuron disease, which affects nerves throughout the spinal cord, or neurons, I should say, throughout the spinal cord of the horse, and leads to really profound muscle loss and weakness. There are intoxications, toxicities that can affect the nervous system and lead to both brain and spinal cord dysfunction. So yeah, there are a number of ones, and probably more than we can talk about in half an hour or so.
Yeah, but that's a good overview. As we wrap up today, do you have any advice for veterinarians who are working in the field or in hospital settings, or anything else you'd like to add on this topic?
I mean, I don't think I have any advice other than to keep an open mind. And when a case is having odd behavior or performance problems or a really tricky lameness, to remember the possibility of neurologic disease, because they can sometimes, again, occur very insidiously and slowly over time. And the sooner you recognize the that neurologic disease might be one of the contributing factors to the horse's problems, the sooner you can address it. And hopefully that will result in a better prognosis for the horse, especially as we refine our treatment options.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Johnson, for joining us today. I think this has been a really great overview of some of these conditions.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to say thank you again to Dr. Johnson for joining us, and thank you to Equithrive for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Disease Du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please send me an email at csisson@equinenetwork.com.